Welcome to another episode of the Rain Race Podcast. Sebastian Vettel took the sports car racing world by surprise last week with his test of a Porsche 963 for Porsche Penske Motorsport. We're going to be giving our thoughts on a potential Le Mans run for him, along with discussing some of the latest news from IMSA and the WEC, and answering your questions. If you enjoy this episode and you want to join us for the live discussion in the future, you can check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/@GTRain. Again, that's youtube.com/@GTRain. Until next time, enjoy. All right, I think we finally made it. I'll tell you what, even the most reliable of endurance racing sports cars sometimes have reliability issues.
It's
and
true.
It turns out sometimes the not so reliable endurance racing podcasters also have the same issues. But we're here. It's another episode of the Rain Race Podcast. Thank you all for being patient and bearing with us as we figured out those technical issues. We should be on the road now for a pretty decent episode. I'm your host, GT Rain. I got alongside me, as always, my co-host, Off in the S's. How are you doing tonight?
I think we're going to have to work on using our Joker for some reliability upgrades in future seasons here.
Yeah, talk about that. You know, I'll oust YouTube on one of this, though, because for whatever reason, even on the second attempt we had it going live, it didn't want to pick it up, and I thought we were going to have to Control-Alt-Delete cycle the engine or whatever they do in the pit lane of those hypercar teams, but we got it working. I got a couple people in the chat already. Thank you for tuning in. Dove Jones in here, Gam Wolfers. Glad I could finally catch a stream hard as y'all start at 2 a.m., European time. Yeah, I'm really sorry about that, by the way. One of the difficult things with having a podcast that encompasses a global racing format or a global racing series in the World Endurance Championship is finding a time that works for all of us and finding a day that works for all of us. I'd love to try to be a little bit more accommodating to the European listeners, but unfortunately, it's almost the best we can work with for now, but we'll see for the future. Good evening to Timo Bella as well. If you have any questions that you guys want to ask, as always, same spiel, you can throw those in the chat during this episode. We got a lot of great questions in the last episode, hoping to keep that momentum rolling for this one. Oh, and it looks like some people are talking about buffering. Maybe this is a global YouTube issue tonight.
Maybe.
So hopefully things go all right on that end. If not, you can let me know. And worst case scenario, the recorded version will be going up on podcasting platforms everywhere right after the show ends. I want to start things off tonight talking about perhaps the biggest story to hit sports car racing for the past couple of months, which is that Sebastian Vettel, sort of out of nowhere, might I add, tested the Porsche 963 in part of a 36-hour endurance racing test at Aragon for Porsche Penske Motorsport. Now, this is the first time that Vettel got his hands on modern sports car racing equipment, first time maybe for sports car racing equipment in general. You think of Sebastian Vettel, long-time open-wheel driver, Formula One world champion 4 times. Very popular driver still, even though he's been retired for a couple of seasons now in the world of motorsports, getting his first taste of some WEC machinery. As I said, this was part of another 36-hour endurance test for Porsche in preparation for the 24 Hours of Le Mans in just over 2 months' time. I feel like Porsche's been doing, I don't know how many of those 36-hour tests, but I know they've done quite a few of them at this point. They did a 36-hour test at Sebring, I think, over the off-season. Now doing another one at Aragon. I think they've done one at Spa in the past as well. We've talked all season about how strong Porsche's reliability has looked this season. Doesn't just come out of nowhere, I guess we'll say that. One of the quotes from Sebastian Vettel, this is direct from the Porsche media release. I just said, of course, I always keep an eye on other motorsport disciplines and know many other drivers who are active in the WEC and Le Mans. At some point, my curiosity was so great that I had the idea of trying it out myself. Porsche gave me the opportunity to test a current hypercar with the 963. After the seat adjustment, the simulator session, and the rollout in Vysac, I already had a good feeling. Driving the Porsche 963 on the track here in Aragon, that was definitely fun. I first had to get used to everything, find my rhythm. The driving experience is different simply because of the roof over your head, as well as dealing with the higher weight and the tires. Porsche Works drivers were very helpful and explained to me what was special and what I needed to get used to. That made it easy for me. Sort of mentioned in that article there, or in that quote there, that he was not alone in that test. He was joined alongside the other Porsche Works drivers from the WEC, Matt Campbell, Michael Christensen, Fred Makovecki, and car number 5, and the sister car 6. You had Kevin Estra, Andre Lutter, Lawrence Vantor, and also getting some seat time in the 963 was Thomas Prining, the former DTM champion from last season, getting some seat time in car number 6. Vettel himself completed a total of 118 laps, which was 581 kilometers, did 2 double stints during the endurance test. So good amount of mileage for him in that car. Got it up to speed as well. I think they said they were doing almost 200 miles an hour on the straightaway there. Now the big question here, the million-dollar question everybody wants to know the answer to, will Sebastian Vettel be racing at Le Mans this year? Now there's 2 open seats still for Porsche. They have the number 4 car, that third entry, that will be coming over with, we'd like to imagine, some of the IMSA guys. But they still have 2 open seats in that car right now. Matter of fact, the only confirmed driver for that car right now is Matthew Jaminet from IMSA. So you might wonder, maybe Vettel gets to get slotted into a seat there. Maybe there's an opening there. I think Porsche would definitely not turn down the publicity bump that having a driver like Sebastian Vettel would bring. And it would be a huge signing. And I confidently say it would bring hundreds of thousands of new people to watch the 24 hours of Le Mans. If you want to measure popularity or the scope of a news story based on the Gen Z way that I take, which is looking at social media metrics, the Ferrari post when they won Le Mans last year, they had a couple of posts when they won Le Mans, but you think Ferrari, major manufacturer, arguably the most popular manufacturer in worldwide motorsports, winning the world's most popular, most prestigious endurance race, 175,000 likes on their primary Instagram post for that race-winning result. Sebastian Vettel only testing a car in Aragon. That's it, just testing, sitting in the car, a couple pictures. 315,000 likes on Instagram. So I don't think that you need a whole lot more to show the scope of what that would bring to the 24 Hours of Le Mans, what that would bring to endurance racing if he ended up in that number 4 car for Le Mans this year. Now, Stu, I want to get some of your thoughts on this. Obviously, it's a big story. There's still some uncertainty, but I want to get some of your thoughts on what this would mean if he was able to find that seat at Le Mans.
Yeah, I mean, you don't think that Porsche would go out of their way to make it, you know, this public of an appearance at a test if there wasn't something behind this. You would think, you know, if they were trying to, you know, ease their way into this and trying to evaluate Vettel a little bit to see if this is something they might want to explore in the future, then this would be done hush hush, which is very difficult to do in today's world, let's be real. But the way that Porsche have attacked this and have been very upfront about the whole process and the fact that we have this much information to talk about from this test, it makes you think that there's something behind this. Whether it is, you know, Vettel is being evaluated for one of those factory seats. The other thing that crossed my mind is, and Dove mentioned this in the comments, that he's been rumored for a ride somewhere for some time now, dating back to last season. Last season it was with Joda, in you know, their additional ride that they were that they have for this season. But the question that I kind of have that pops into my head, and is there an additional seat that's available in one of the customer entries that we know of right now, or are all of those spoken for? Because I would almost wonder if Porsche would go through the motions of, you know, getting him up to pace and having him for some of these factory tests, but then ultimately have him injected into one of the customer entries. That's where my thought process was.
So to my knowledge, the answer is no, because only 3 drivers are allowed at Le Mans. You're not allowed to have a 4th in the car, as we saw at Daytona. Most of those customer cars, actually all of those customer cars, will just be running their standard WEC lineup. The only gray area there is the second Proton that's on the reserve list right now. You know, also a Porsche 963. Maybe that gets brought into the conversation if they get bumped up into the actual race. I personally think that Vettel brings enough prestige and enough publicity that if he did end up wanting to race at Le Mans, they would throw him in the top seat with the best chance to win the race. I think Porsche would be a little bit short-sighted to pass up on that opportunity. Now, of course, Porsche has arguably the greatest and most strong, talented field of factory drivers in endurance racing right now. They have no shortage of incredibly talented drivers to pick from. So even if he doesn't end up in the four car, they're going to be able to fill that seat with some of the IMSA drivers perfectly fine. But I still think with the publicity that Vettel would bring to the team, the amount of merchandise they would be able to sell from that,
yeah,
and the amount of just eyes in general they'd be able to pull from a move like that, that would be what they'd want to do. The only other car, for what is worth to my knowledge, that has an open seat in the hypercar class at Le Mans this year is the 311 Action Express Cadillac. You want to do a 180 and see if that happens, then throw your dart at the board. But no, I personally think if he goes to Le Mans this year, it's going to be in that number four car.
And you know what, too, to support that idea is Porsche's, they've done this. They did it not on the scale of Sebastian Vettel, but with another really big name driver from another series in Joseph Newgarden, bringing him into the fold with, you know, a few tests, a little bit more testing than this, but we don't know if there has been any additional testing that Vettel has done behind the scenes prior to this. It sounds like there's been a bunch of simulator work that's or at least some simulator work that's been done. So it's not like Porsche haven't done this before with in bringing a driver in for a race like this.
Yeah, yeah, and they're not really skeptical of doing that. Now, the interesting thing, I guess the 180 of this, is Roger Penske sort of explained why they don't want to put Newgarden in the car at Le Mans, and saying that we want to really pick from the factory drivers that are more acclimated to the car for the biggest challenge that they have of the season. Now, if Vettel jumped in and was able to do that, then that's sort of a 180 of what Penske said there, but maybe that's a call that comes from the top at Porsche. This is all speculation, though, at the end of the day. I think, you know, I hate to be a little bit pessimistic, but I personally think the odds of him actually showing up to Le Mans this year are probably below 50%.
Showing up to race. Showing up to race,
correct. showing up in the garage to support the team, maybe a different story. For the future, though, there's a lot of movement that's going to be going on next season as well, with a couple of additional new manufacturers. So, you know, maybe that gets brought into the fold. Maybe he doesn't end up racing for Porsche at Le Mans. Maybe he doesn't end up racing at Le Mans in general. Maybe he comes back and races full time next year. You know, I think the biggest thing with this test was getting some experience in modern prototype machinery. He achieved that. And now he has sort of the ability to approach other teams or have other teams approach him for a full-time ride next season or for a Le Mans drive next season. I think that's probably the more likely option, but boy, I'll tell you again, it would be a massive thing for the 24 Hours of Le Mans if he got the call up this year.
Now, it would be incredible. I mean, we're seeing, you know, Jenson Button is coming in and, you know, racing in sports car racing, but no offense to Jenson Button. I mean, we're comparing Jenson Button to Sebastian Vettel, who is one of the arguably the greatest drivers that we've seen, you know, potentially ever. I don't think it's that crazy to say that. At least a driver that, you know, he's won pretty much everything that there is to win in Formula One. He's very highly regarded, and this would be huge for endurance racing as a whole and sports car racing. If we're able to see Sebastian Vettel come over, race in a Porsche, no less. Like, this is an entry that, you know, is going to be expected to win the race this year. Like, Porsche is going in last year, they're going in hoping, you know, to finish, get a good result. They're expecting to win this year. And right. It would be a huge statement if they bring Sebastian Vettel in to bolster their lineup heading into the biggest race of the season.
Yeah. And I saw in the chat, Gam Wolfers mentioned it's Alonso Mania all over again. Of course, referencing Fernando Alonso, who did the full season for the 2018-2019 super season. I think that's a little bit different just in the stance that the WEC was not as strong back then as it is now in terms of fan interest, in terms of manufacturer interest. There's a lot of eyes already on the championship as it stands. Of course, Alonso winning Le Mans two times with that 100% victory record still was big in his bid for the Triple Crown that looks like it's fallen a bit short, lacking that Indy 500 win. But I think that this story would bring probably even more attention to the race than we saw with Alonso. So that's pretty much the speculation for me to go over there. We'll continue following this if we get additional updates, but for now, I think that's where I'll leave it. And we'll see where we go from there. So we got an interesting sort of weird... Talk about things that dropped out of the middle of nowhere. Yeah. We got an interesting post on social media in the past week or so that relates to AWA's Corvette effort in the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. And I said IMSA, and Stu, that means it's all for you.
Yeah, so this was definitely a head scratcher. I think the way that I found out about this was had a Reddit notification that popped up, and it was with this article or this image from Instagram, and I thought, what on earth is going on? And it was sure enough, Anthony Mantella, one of the drivers for the number 17 AWA Corvette, of course. Mantella raced with AWA last year in I almost said LMGT3, LMP3, and of course they picked up at least two wins. I believe it was the Rolex and Indianapolis. They picked up wins there, if I'm not mistaken. So there was some success here last year. Anthony Mantella has been kicking around the IMSA paddock for a number of years now, in one form or another. But of course, making the jump to Corvette this year and their new GTD program. So Anthony Mantella announced that he has put the number 17 Corvette up for sale in an interesting Instagram post. The team later backed that up, saying that the number 17 car will not continue for the remainder of the season. But the number 13 does remain on the grid, so that is good. We've seen, more backed up or more, resulting news come out of this in that the hauler for AWA they're selling one of the haulers. Pretty easy to put two and two together and say, that's probably what they were hauling the number 17 car around with. Anthony Mantella, number 17, is not going to be on the grid for the remainder of the season that we're aware of. I suppose there is still a possibility that whoever buys that Corvette, if it is another driver, they could get brought up to speed. And I don't know how this would work with the IMSA entry and everything, but I suppose it's possible that we could see them on the grid at some point later in the season. I'm sure there's not going to be a lack of interest in buying that Corvette, whether it be from a driver in the market or some sort of a collector. Although it kind of makes you wonder if Corvette has any sort of say, especially with the program so young, if they can help sort of dictate where that car is going to land. Cause of course they're going to want to see that. They're going to want to see that car still remain on the IMSA grid, but yeah, pretty strange story all around. We know that the Corvettes, among some of the other new cars, have been plagued with reliability issues. AWA has been particularly hard hit. The 13, you'll recall the start of the Rolex 24. It was sitting on pit road for the start of that race. I don't know. I don't think the 17 missed the start for Sebring. I think they only ended up running like two laps in the race, or a very, very low number of laps in Sebring. So it's been a very rough start to the season for them. But yeah, really unfortunate to see this. And certainly shocking news to come across last week.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, this all came about in a bit of a, let's be generous here and say, a bit of a passive-aggressive Instagram post that seemed to have, I guess, called out Corvette, not Corvette Racing and the Pratt & Miller side that we think of, but the customer side of things. Of course, Corvette is only now really returning to customer cars that are officially built by Pratt & Miller. Previously, the... I guess the last customer Corvettes that we had seen were the Callaway C7 GT3.Rs, which were not affiliated with Pratt & Miller. It sort of makes me question the how teams feel about Corvette's customer racing operations, you know, in the behind the scenes. We have seen manufacturers step away from another manufacturer for lack of support. We saw sort of a similar story with Pfaff and Porsche. This, though, after two races, and I know, like you said, the car has been struggling at the beginning of the season, but this seems to me like it's a... It just doesn't seem normal to me that you would ditch the program that soon. And I can't imagine that it's all 100% down just to the reliability issues with the car. Because you'd have to expect some of those issues with a car this new, and they're not the only ones. They wouldn't be any more happier if they were a Ford customer team right now. I can tell you that much. It just makes me question what's going on behind the scenes for the Corvette customer racing operation. So we'll have to see what the rest of the season looks like, but it's a big shame to lose that car already. It was probably one of the fan favorites in the GTD class just for the sole purpose of being a Corvette with a big fan following in IMSA. Just sort of a weird story that, again, came up a bit out of nowhere.
Yeah, like, really strange. And the first, honestly, it sucks that that car's not going to be on the grid for the rest of the year. Really, the first thing that came to my mind when I really sort of, I guess, ingested this news was, you know, AWA has done a really good job over the past. They're a really good story of, like, making your way up through the ranks of IMSA in particular. In this case, you know, they've started in the Michelin Pilot Challenge. They ran a bit in the Prototype Challenge, made their way to LMP3, and then this was a really big step for them to jump into the GTD class with a manufacturer like Corvette. I mean, like, who wouldn't have wanted to partner up with Corvette in the launch of these customer cars? And I just really, really hope that, you know, a team that has worked so hard for so many years, that this doesn't set them back really significantly, because... that's really what you definitely don't want to see that. And I just hope that the ideal end to this story is that there's going to be, you know, a driver that steps up, purchases the car, and is looking to run the car with the team. And, you know, AWA is able to bring that car onto the grid again later this year. That's the ideal end to this story. But really unfortunate news. And, you know, hopefully AWA ends up being okay. They can pick up another program somewhere and keep that team busy.
Yeah. And if nothing else, hopefully they're able to divert some of the resources over to the other car, the sister car, and maybe find a little bit more success for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Also curious what the future holds for Nico Varone. He was the co-driver in that car. I don't know if we've heard anything official yet on where he's going to end up.
Yeah, no, I have not. That there's been no news on that.
Okay. You know, another big talent, though, won the World Endurance Championship in the GTE AM class last season. So really hope that he finds his way on his feet again after sort of something that was out of his control. Got a couple of people in the chat calling for the Ran Race podcast racing team, which, you know, I'll tell you what, I'd be open for that if we could put the funding together, but we're going to need a platinum driver and we're going to need a few million dollars first.
Yeah, definitely a few million dollars.
Okay, I'll move things on to the next story. I want to talk about the Evo spec Peugeot 9X8 that was officially unveiled. We've talked about this in the past. We basically knew exactly what we were going to be getting out of that new car before it was officially unveiled, but we've seen it now. We've seen the new livery. We've got confirmation of the adjustments they made for that car. Most notable addition, of course, is that of the rear wing. The Wingless Warrior, as I like to have formerly called it, is now no more. Although it still does look, to its credit, it still does look very unique and very unlike its LMDH and LMH competitors. So I'll still give them credit for the ambitious car, even though it has a rear wing now. 29-centimeter front tires on the car now and 34-centimeter rear tires as compared to the 31-centimeter all-round tires that they had on the car previously. Hopefully the result of that is a car that is just a little bit more consistent all around. The big thing with that car, said it many times now, is that it was very circuit dependent. Take it to a track like Sebring, forget it, because you have a very bumpy surface that they have to raise the ride height under the car. The ground effects are nowhere near as efficient as they should be, and the car struggled. It was really nowhere. You bring it to a track like Le Mans, led a good amount of the race. Qatar led a good amount of the race. Actually didn't really lead quite as much there, but was a strong contender there. Had a P2 finish almost locked up until they broke down, or they didn't break down, but they ran out of fuel in the last couple of laps, with a very flat surface again there and a very smooth surface. So hopefully these new changes, the main goal with that is to make the car a lot less circuit dependent. You can bring it to a track like Fuji or Imola, which is where we're going to see its debut in just over 2 weeks' time, by the way. And hopefully they're just up to speed a lot quicker. The other interesting thing I picked out of this announcement, I guess the only real bit of new news that we got apart from the new livery, is that 90% of the bodywork on the car, according to Peugeot themselves, was modified. So, you know, call it what you want, but it seems like they made quite a bit more changes on this car than what we initially had thought. The entire car, it's not just slapping a wing on the car that we've seen for the 2022, 2023 and past race at Qatar. It looked like they really reworked the entire aerodynamics on the car to be more efficient and fit that new design philosophy. They also said that they put some additional, they took the chance while they were getting the car re-homologated to add some additional reliability and performance upgrades to the car. I'm curious to see what that brings starting at Imola and reliability upgrades for Le Mans, which actually the car was more reliable than I think people expected at Le Mans this year, or last year rather. Did have a couple of issues in the middle of the race, but for the most part, we're looking a little bit okay there, or looking pretty okay there. And I think that's what I got to cover there. Like I said, the first race will be at Imola in 2 weeks' time for us to see what sort of results they can get with that car. Maybe try to back up the podium that they lost at Qatar.
One of the other interesting things that I think I saw with this unveiling, or not saw, I guess read, and a quote from the team is, a big part of this car and the improvements that they made were to make it less, not only circuit dependent, but BOP dependent. Right. You know, we saw Peugeot's their best performance in this last the season opening round with basically all of the BOP, you know, everything was wide open for them. Essentially, it was mm-hmm. the lightest the car has been, if I'm not mistaken. Car was at absolutely max power. So that was literally the best performance that, you know, you could get out of that car. And I think there were one of the big, you mentioned improved consistency and making the car less circuit dependent. And then also, of course, being less dependent on BOP to have your speed. And, you know, if you can have a car that runs great and, you know, that's if you have a car that runs great, but if you have a car that runs great even when it's not at its maximum potential BOP, then that's going to be really, really good for them. And hopefully, you know, the wheel sizes being changed, or those tire sizes, yep, are hopefully going to do a lot for them. this, I'm pretty sure this puts them in line with pretty much every other car that's competing in that class. And yeah, because I think a lot of people want to cheer for Peugeot, and especially the big swing that they took with that wingless car. And I think, you know, the season opener was a great taste of what could be. And then hopefully this new car is just going to build on that.
Right. A couple of questions I have. So the first one is the hybrid deployment speed. They were the only car in the class that was deploying its hybrid power at 150 kilometers per hour, as opposed to 190. Now that was all dictated by the tire size. So I assume now, when they get on the ground at Imola, they'll be in the same boat as the other manufacturers. I think that played a decent hand in why they were so strong in the rain last year at Le Mans. You might not think that 40 kilometer per hour difference is going to be a whole lot. But when you're able to deploy that four-wheel drive 40 kilometers per hour quicker than the other cars that you're competing against, I think that's going to certainly help a little bit. Now, Toyota also made the same change with their tires, I think, at the end of the, or the start, rather, of the 2022 season, from the 31-centimeter tires all around to the 29-34 layout. And they seem to have also noted an improvement making that change. So, the other thing, the last thing, actually, I wanted to talk about with this is the hypercar manufacturers. I got to be specific. The cars that are under the hypercar regulations, not the LMDH regulations, are allowed 5 Joker upgrades that they can make on the car. Now, I don't know how those Joker upgrades are actually determined. I know that safety and reliability upgrades do not count as part of that. Which is why Porsche didn't end up using any for, I don't believe they ended up using any for their upgraded 963 that came out at the beginning of this season. I also don't know how many Peugeot used for the Evo version of this car. I don't think that's been made public at this time. But if I'm not mistaken, they're the second manufacturer in the hypercar category to take advantage of those upgrades. Toyota had previously put them in at the start of the 2023 season, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that covers that. Like I said, we already mentioned quite a bit of that in a previous episode, but it's all official now, and we'll see what impacts those changes have in a couple weeks' time. The last news story I want to go over tonight is a relatively short episode with news, and we don't have any races to review, so we'll get to some of the questions after this. But another late weeks-long disqualification came in the World Endurance Championship for the number 2 Cadillac. This came out just a couple of days ago. It was made public a couple of days ago. I'm going to bore everybody here, so if I look at the viewer metrics and I see them tanking off, I'll know why, but bear with me for a couple minutes here. Basically, the entire reason for the disqualification was the bodywork was not complying with the homologated form of the car. An inquiry was submitted the following morning, very early in the morning after the race, where they basically wanted to investigate the car. And although the results were final weeks ago, they were still subject to the inquiry that was being finalized, which involved a 3D scan of the car post-race and a lengthy comparison to the CAD models that were submitted by Cadillac. And I have the document that was posted by the FIA and ACO. This is decision number 96. And it says, at post-race scrutineering, a 3D scan was performed on car 2 to analyze the bodywork compliance compared to the official manufacturer bodywork CAD model deposited at the car's homologation. The result from the 3D scan and further investigation show that this rear diffuser strakes fitted on the left side and right side are higher in misaligned, higher in Z-axis and misaligned in Y-axis than the nominal value from the official bodywork CAD and the allowed tolerances. All of that resulted in a lengthy investigation. The team manager was summoned to a video conference on March 20th. And the end result of that is a disqualification for that car. from the results at Qatar and really puts them on the back foot for their early 2024 WEC campaign. This is obviously not the first time we've seen a disqualification weeks after a race. We talked in detail about Daytona last year and the fallout from that. This is something a little bit different. This was actually picked up by the official technical review process. But I will note that this is also not the only time a GM-affiliated team has run into issues with cars not following technical regulations this season. We saw a couple of Corvettes run into issues in Sebring qualifying. True. I think we talked about that last episode. It's just interesting to see sort of the, I don't want to say fall from grace quite yet, but the number of penalties that we're seeing out of GM affiliated racing programs right now in both IMSA and the WEC.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. I don't know how this happens. Like, I mean, I understand how it happens, but this is the first race of the season. You're bringing the car for this race, and for it to be, disqualified for, whether it was improperly assembled or whether these parts were, modified from how they were originally homologated, is, we don't really know that. But it's also what a blow for Chip Ganassi Racing. Like, it comes out in the lead up to Sebring that they're out as the runner of Cadillac in the WEC, the sole runner in the WEC, and then also their IMSA entry. And then you follow that up with a couple weeks later, and the car that they ran in the WEC opener gets disqualified. It's I don't know. It's kind of it's a bit of a mystery, but I don't really know what to say about it, to be honest. I mean, you mentioned it. I never even thought either that, Corvette also had some issues in Sebring qualifying, of course, with some parts that they had that were not homologated, and ultimately had to start the race from the back. But this is wild. I'm just surprised that this has happened in, 2024.
Yeah. Well, the thing that we didn't get about this technical document that came out is we don't know how far off those rear diffuser strikes were. They didn't give us a measurement in millimeters or something like that. It seems like they usually do provide that information. So we don't know how severe or how minor the infringement was. It could have just been a simple mistake. We've seen this before. We saw Porsche get disqualified last year. We've seen cars in the WEC get disqualified from race wins in the past as well. I'm still frustrated about Audi in 2016 at Silverstone. But, if this was a very minor breach and we're talking about a difference of a couple of millimeters, then, I'm going to chalk this one up to a simple mistake or something that got miscommunicated potentially. Like you said, and like I said, it's just interesting that it's happened again, and it's happened so early on in the season, and really puts them on the back foot.
And it happened to Chip Ganassi Racing. Yeah. Just kick them while they're down. Yeah.
Yep. Dove Jones in the chat saying, speaking of, didn't Ferrari get fined for Qatar? Yes. The 54, of course, GT, or I'm sorry, I almost said GTEM, LMGT3 car also got fined from the race as well, although not for, I don't believe it was a technical breach.
It was personnel. They had I think three personnel that ended up working on the car in one form or another that were not eligible to work on the car, because there are a set number of team members that can work on the car. And yeah, that's another interesting one, whether that was intentional or not, or that was a just an honest mistake, is not a great mistake to make, for sure. Yep. For them.
Right. All right, I'm going to end the episode up with some questions here. I've seen a couple that I wanted to circle back to from earlier on in the episode. We can keep asking those right now if you want to try to get some of those in before we wrap the show up. First one, Timo Bella, Well, first question, do you guys have plans to collab with Only Endurance from Instagram? You know, I'd love to collab with Tim from the Only Endurance page. The only issue with it I see is, again, the whole thing that circles back to us being at a poor time for Europeans. But perhaps at some point we get an earlier episode in and then we could accommodate something like that. I'd love to do a collab if he was open to it. Let's see. We got Dove Jones was talking about the Proton competition, Porsche for Sebastian Vettel potentially racing there. So it's a question for Proton competition, but I don't know because I think they're not pursuing an additional chassis for the WEC. So yeah, to my knowledge, actually, I'm not sure if they're pursuing anything for next year yet. They still have that car on the reserve list. To my knowledge, that is still there, and they haven't pulled that car out of the reserve list yet. But it's all dependent on somebody else dropping out of the race. Didn't Alonso do a full season of the WC during his time at Toyota? Yep, he did the 18-19 super season, which was one season across 2 years when they used to do that.
This is car racing isn't confusing at all.
No, not a bit. This is an interesting one that also came out about a week back or so. Tara saying, do you think Forsythe buying the rest of the Long Beach Grand Prix ownership is a good sign for the longevity of IMSA at the event? Yeah, we didn't talk about this, but last week it was publicly unveiled that NASCAR was at least considering purchasing the second half of the Long Beach Grand Prix ownership that was owned by the estate of Kevin Kalkoven, who was the former owner of Champ Car or CART. The other half of the ownership goes to Gerald Forsythe, who was owned the event. Can't remember how long they've owned the event, but it's been quite a while, back into the Champ Car days at least. Now, if NASCAR were to acquire the second half of that ownership, it really would have put the IndyCar race in jeopardy there. Although I wonder what that would have done for the IMSA race had they have gone through with that buyout. Of course, IMSA owned by NASCAR, so I would like to imagine that they would remain safe. Although I guess that'll be one of the questions for the rest of history that we'll never know the answer to. Because ultimately, Forsythe bought out the rest of the event. I mean, Jerry Forsythe said he wants to keep it an IndyCar-focused event, and I think that's perfectly fine. The IMSA event, I think, will make no arguments to the fact that it's sort of a support race there that weekend. But I would like to hope that they are in okay hands right now. It's you know, they're still in the hands of somebody who seems like he's fine with having IMSA there as a support race. IndyCar, to my knowledge, doesn't have any plans on bringing any of their support series there. So I'm hoping that the event there at Long Beach is safe, even though it doesn't live up to the prestige of the IndyCar event there. I like to imagine that Long Beach is still one of the more popular events on the IMSA calendar that they have.
Yeah. I've definitely heard very many good things about that event as a whole, and my vibe from the whole, or what I was picking up based on this whole series of events, is that you know, the new owner, sorry, I apologize, I can't remember his name. Jerry Forsythe. He wants to essentially just maintain status quo, sort of deal with the race, is keep things as it's been, doesn't want to see any significant changes that that, you know, obviously a NASCAR purchase would bring. So I don't think we're going to see IMSA go anywhere anytime soon. That's been a pretty long and good partnership between the two. So, and it's loved by the fans as well. So,
Mr. Waffle said, what does everyone think of this two-car mandate for Hypercar next year? This was not officially confirmed yet. I believe this came out as an article from Autosport, motorsport.com earlier in the week. I will put a link to that in the description and the show notes. I did not come prepared with any of the quotes from that article, but the gist of it is that the WEC is considering implementing a new regulation where you have to have two cars. Each manufacturer has to have two cars minimum to be eligible for the full championship. Now, if you're a customer manufacturer, a customer team rather, like Jota or Proton, you wouldn't be required to have that second car to be eligible. It's just for the manufacturer's sake. Now, I'm pretty opinionated about this. I gave my 240 character opinion on this on X by now. I think it's a ridiculous regulation if they do try to implement it. I don't see any positive that it really brings apart from, I guess, maybe forcing a manufacturer who is only considering bringing one car to bring a second. But I think at the same time, it's just equally hurting the chance of seeing privateer manufacturers or boutique manufacturers on the grid. And one of the things that I've been very vocal about is you cannot push out the boutique manufacturers right now. You cannot upset them. You cannot, you know, show them the door, because eventually, who knows when it'll be? It can be 3 years, 5 years, 8 years. I have no idea, but eventually there will be a time when Porsche leaves and Lamborghini leaves and Alpine, BMW, Aston Martin, all of these manufacturers head out, and we're going to want these boutique manufacturers to remain interested in the series and remember what the series provided for them at its peak. To me, this entire philosophy of we're going to force manufacturers to have two cars each, it seems like it's hurting those boutique manufacturers more than anybody else. I think Cadillac could afford to put a second car on the grid. There's already discussions on them having a second car next year with whatever team that program ends up in the hands of. Aston Martin, they're a bit of a question that I have, because they were planning, to my knowledge, one car in the WEC and one car in IMSA. What does that mean for the IMSA program? Does that mean the IMSA program gets tossed aside? Does that mean the WEC program gets tossed aside? Does that mean that they run two cars in the WEC and one car in IMSA? I'm not sure. But it, to me, is just a bit of an overstep. I don't know. I don't think it's necessary to be mandating this regulation. Lamborghini is running one car this season. I don't see anybody complaining about that. So I'm going to leave it at there, because it's not confirmed. If they do confirm it, I'll give you a full length rant. But yeah, to me, it doesn't sit right with me. And I hope that they don't actually end up implementing that. Stu, any of your thoughts on that, though? Maybe you're a bit more level-headed.
Well, no, I agree with what you're saying, that, you know, it definitely hurts boutique manufacturers. But I mean, at this, I guess, I don't know. I don't really know where I stand on it, because my concern is more on the, you know, you can't force out. My concern would be, if something like this is implemented, does it take away from the GT entries? You know, does that in some sort of a way, does this lead to that AM is supported or AM focused LMGT3 class? Like, does that, do you limit entries in that more in order to accommodate these additional entries in the hypercar class? Because if you can't do that either, you mentioned that you got to remember these boutique manufacturers are important when, you know, the numbers start to decline a little bit, which they inevitably will. We know that sports car racing goes in cycles. But when there is the inevitable, you know, whether it's a slight decline, whatever it might be, making sure the AM drivers are also, you know, a very much a big part of it, because ultimately that's one of the main reasons why we have the series that we do today, is because of the support from these amateur drivers who obviously pay for lots of the bills for their entries and support the series. That's where my thought comes into it. I can see the pros and cons of having two car entries and having a mandate for that. You know, it means that, you know, you do have to be more serious if you're going to take the leap into the World Endurance Championship, a prestigious series like that. But if you are going to implement a two-car mandate, how do you accommodate for, like you said, those boutique manufacturers you know, that that are just looking to, you know, to enter into the fold is, because they can't really race. You can't really race a hypercar anywhere else in any other series as a buildup to the WEC. Right. So there, it's all a balancing act, I guess, at the end of the day. And, you know, none of this is official yet, so we'll see. Maybe this is one of those, you know, we just want to get an initial reaction from fans and from the manufacturers and the teams and see if this is something that would actually be welcomed. But I don't know. I haven't seen too much positive, I guess, towards this one, but.
Yeah. Well, to your point, if Asada Fraschini can't race in the WEC, if Glickenhaus can't race in the WEC, well, they're already not racing in the WEC anymore. Van Wall can't race in the WEC. They can't race in IMSA because they don't have that eligibility in IMSA that they have in the WEC, which you know, mandates that it's a recognized manufacturer that sells 2,500 road cars. That's not a requirement for the WEC. And I think that that was one of the beauties of the hypercar regulation, is that you can get these small manufacturers that go in and compete against the huge guys. What it boils down to me, is would you rather have two cars on the grid or would you rather have no cars on the grid?
Yeah.
Because where does this leave a manufacturer like Cadillac if they say we can only bring one car next year? We can't. There's not enough customer interest for us to bring that second car. I don't think that's going to happen, for what it's worth.
Yeah.
But as a hypothetical, okay, now we have no Cadillacs on the grid for next season when we could have had one. You know, that's where it boils down to for me. And I think the issue here at stake is, to me, it seems like the WEC has a big issue with getting complacent. And when they ride the highs that they do, whether it be LMP1 or GTE Pro, or now maybe potentially with the hypercar category, they start to get complacent and they start to overstep a little bit. And I think that that just leads to increased frustration from some of the manufacturers. It leads to increased costs. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't take very long for the formula or for the class to die. We've seen that in the past 10 years alone. We've seen that with two different classes now. And I'm not going to say, you know, shift 100% of the blame to the WEC for that. But we've seen a trend from them in the past of getting comfortable with the manufacturers that they have and then sort of just making decisions on their own. I hope that this isn't an example of that. I hope that this is something that they give a second thought to. And more than anything else, I hope this is something that doesn't impact the series in a negative way. How would you improve the quality and grid sizes of GT World Challenge America? I think, for one, it needs to be distinguished from IMSA GTD. So, you know what that all boils down to is GT3 seems to be the only top GT formula that really works nowadays in motorsports. GTE was really the last dying breed of separation that we had from the GT3 masterclass, I guess you could call it. And unfortunately, that too got a little bit too expensive, was a little bit too niche, and then look what we have in the WEC and IMSA nowadays as well. We have GT3 cars in both of them. The WEC initially tried hinting at doing sort of a GT3, what did they call it? Like a GT3 premium or plus or something like that.
Yeah.
Where they had Le Mans specific or WEC specific aero on the car. Didn't end up really panning out. We just have GT3 cars there with, I think there's slight modifications to the cars that differentiate them from standard GT3 homologated cars that you'd see in the GT World Challenge, but for the most part, very similar. I don't really know if there's anything I would do, to be honest with you, because I don't think there's anything else right now that makes sense for the for other series. The interest right now in global sports car racing is with prototype racing. And it's a cycle where it'll switch between manufacturers being interested in GT racing and manufacturers being interested in prototype racing. 5 years ago, we saw all the manufacturers pouring all their money into GTE, really, and GT racing in general. And now we're seeing not really a big fall off in GT racing because GT3 is still very strong. But more of those manufacturers have shifted their factory interest over to prototype racing. So for the time being, I don't think there is another formula or another option that really exists for any of these championships, be it IMSA or GT World Challenge or the WEC, that would really work better for them. Is there anything else that they can do to improve the grid sizes? Again, I don't really think so. I think they already are working with the best option they have.
Yeah.
You know, I guess at that rate, yeah, I got nothing. I got completely nothing.
I mean, I would almost put forward the argument that it already is pretty distinguished from what IMSA's GTD class, in the sense, you know, like, it's not multi-class racing. IMSA, right, of course, is, with the exception of what, one race a year where IMSA runs GTD Pro and GTD, where it's all the same cars out on track at the same time. Like, GT World Challenge America is always just, you know, the GT3 cars that are out ripping around, which is unique in its own sense. I know, you know, you see some comments about, you know, wanting to separate. There were, I swear I saw something about wanting to separate Le Mans into or maybe it wasn't Le Mans, maybe I'm thinking Petit Le Mans, but it, you know, like separating it into a prototype only race and a GT only race. And it's like, I don't know, like, for me, that's not what I love. Sports car racing, yeah. And you know, IMSA is, or WEC is about multi-class, and the WEC, maybe it was becoming an all hypercar class, something along those lines. Like, no, you can't do that. Like, one of the great unique things is multi-class racing and all the storylines and everything that comes with that. But then you look at, you have GT World Challenge America, which is pure GT3 racing. You don't have to worry about the prototype traffic. You get to see these GT3 cars in their element, racing on, again, more iconic tracks around the U.S., you know, you think there's headliner event, the 8 hours of Indy is, you know, that's a great event. They're racing at Sonoma this weekend. This is their season opener at Sonoma this weekend, an incredible track that, frankly, I'm excited to see GT cars run at. So I don't know. I think that there is enough that distinguishes it from, IMSA's GTD class. And I do think if you try and go too crazy with the how you're distinguishing it from GTD, from IMSA's GTD class, you could risk potentially your entry numbers taking a hit if it's not something that, there's a lot of drivers that progress from the GT World Challenge to IMSA. We've seen a number of them make the jump this year. And if it's not that useful of a pipeline anymore, then I wonder if that would hurt potential entries on the grid.
Yeah. I agree with everything you just said. To keep it short. let's see. This is going back to the Force 2 car entry debacle, WEC. Would the IMSA car be fine to race in the WEC season? From a technical standpoint, yes. From a logistics standpoint, no, because we're already seeing the next event at Imola clashing with the IMSA race at Long Beach. And then the following race, I think, for both those championships, Long Beach and Spa are also a clash. So logistically, running the same car in both championships is really not possible. It would just explode the costs if anybody did attempt to do that, yeah. which you know, wouldn't really be possible in the first place. Sort of all goes back to my initial point of it would just make things way too expensive. Do I think the two-car mandate would put some manufacturers in a bad financial spot? Yes, to give you the short answer on that, especially those boutique manufacturers, and some of the manufacturers like Cadillac, which seems like might be relying on more customer focused, or not really customer focused, but on a customer team sort of stepping up to run that program from Chip Ganassi that we see there right now. Do you think McLaren or Ford, for that matter, will ever commit to a hypercar or LMDH program? I give a little chuckle to that because this gets brought up a lot. And it seems like every year somewhere, maybe a couple times a year, we get both of those manufacturers who will just pop in and say, yeah, you know what? We're still thinking about it. We're still, we haven't
forget
forgotten.
About us.
We haven't forgotten. But that's really all we hear from them. And it's been pretty much like that for the past 3-4 years now. And I don't see anything changing in the very near future. I don't know. Some bombshells get dropped on us the week of Le Mans, and I would love to see one or both of those manufacturers commit to a prototype future. But that's one of those trademarked wait-and-see moments, I'll say. I think McLaren just got brought up again. I might be mistaken, but I feel like McLaren got brought up in the past week or so to do their annual "We're still thinking about it" quote. and I know Ford's name was thrown around at Sebring amidst the whole Chip Ganassi Racing departing from Cadillac ordeal. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard anything more substantial than that. So again, we'll continue to look at that, but for now, there's nothing too formal. And I would put the likeliness of both of them, well, both of them would certainly be less, but I think the likeliness of either one of them going in, I wouldn't say is any more than 50% right now if I had to put a bet on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, I think that's pretty accurate. That 50% is probably on the high side, as well. It's,
yeah, that's a little generous.
Yeah.
That's the optimist, you know. You know what? This glass right here is half full.
It's more than half full, actually. So, actually, maybe we can tie that in with Formula Jonah sent a question in on Twitter before the episode, and he said thoughts on which manufacturer Chip Ganassi Racing could partner with post Cadillac departure. I think they could work with Honda or Acura to bring the ARX 06 to the WEC. You mentioned Chip Ganassi Racing. If Ford does actually, again, the small chance that Ford greenlights some sort of a prototype project, then I think Chip Ganassi Racing right now, being as far as we know, a free agent, I think that would be, you know, top dog to go in there. The history that they have with Ford dates back a long time. But could Chip Ganassi Racing help bring Honda Acura to the WEC? Man, I don't know if I could see. Well, I guess Chip Ganassi's a Honda team in IndyCar right now, aren't they?
Yes, but I really don't look into that a whole lot.
Yeah,
with regards of who they align with in the hypercar class, because Penske is a GM manufacturer in IndyCar, and they're out racing Porsches in the WEC. So,
yeah, that's fair.
So yeah, I don't put a whole lot of thought into that. You know what? It all boils down to if Honda and Acura and Honda Racing Global gives the green light for that car to race in the World Endurance Championship, which they still haven't done yet. For the full season, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting prospect. I don't know if it's the most likely one, but you think Wayne Taylor Racing has wanted to go to Le Mans for a while. Andretti has wanted to go to Le Mans for a while. They are sort of Acura's tie-in right now. Over on the IMSA side of things, it would really be a slap in the, it would be a bad hit to them if they didn't find their way to Le Mans and Ganassi did after their commitment to Honda on the Wayne Taylor Racing side, at least, all the way back from earlier in the DPI days. But in terms of the full season, I don't know, maybe that's something more likely.
You would think, though, with the additional investment from Andretti, like Andretti is a big deal coming in to the mix with Wayne Taylor Racing. You would think that, you know, that's probably going to be how they would lean. But I guess
it's a question of whether or not WTR Andretti wants to do a full WEC season or if they just want to race at Le Mans. That's really, I guess, what it boils down to. I've heard a bunch of different speculation on what could happen with Chip Ganassi Racing. I've heard they could be out of sports car racing entirely. I've heard they could align with manufacturer on the Stellantis side, using the 9X8 as a baseline, whether that be the Dodge Ram 1500 or the Alfa Romeo is the name that was thrown around Sebring weekend. Ford, obviously, they get brought up as well, but that's a piece of the puzzle that's not even there yet. So I don't know. I guess if I'm giving you a simple answer to the question, could they partner with Honda and Acura? Yes. I just don't think it's the most likely option.
Yep.
Yeah. Got a couple more things here. Maybe as side episodes, but you guys could talk about tracks you've gone to. Talk about them from a fan's perspective, tips and tricks, and things you should know about going there for the first time. I'll tell you what, we could probably incorporate that into future episodes here.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the races I've been to in my life have been on the IMSA or WEC side. And although I have not been to IMS for the IMSA race, I have been there for the Indy 500 last year. And planning on going back this year, so maybe I can help with that. But
there you go.
But yeah, we can try to incorporate that into future episodes, because I know between the two of us, we've hit probably the majority of the IMSA season or the IMSA calendar between the two of us, or maybe about 50%.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I know. Second half of the season. Well, you're going to Indy, so. Maybe I haven't been to VIR, like VIR Laguna, Long Beach might be some of the ones. Or Road America too. Have you been to Road America?
I have been to Road America. Great track, there you go. By the way.
Well, we're gonna. Yeah, I think we got most of this covered. Maybe the West Coast tracks are going to be an issue, but yeah.
Go talk to Marshall Pruitt for the West Coast tracks.
Yeah,
California native. Let's see. Oh, on that topic here, Landon saying, great news. I'm going to Le Mans. Asada for Skinny, about to unleash the can of whoop ass. Early Le Mans pick, Porsche number 4, of Vettel, Jaminet, and Nasr win. This is going pretty ambitious. Lineup still unconfirmed as a prediction. Well, I'll tell you what, you threw a lot on the table there. You said Asada for Skinny is going to go out and whoop the field. You said the Porsche number 4 is going to be racing with Vettel, Jaminet, and Nasr, and they're going to not only enter the race, but they're going to win. That's a bold prediction there. What I will say is, on topic of advice tracks we've been to, I'm lucky enough to have gone to Le Mans last year. And by the way, Rain Race podcast exclusive. I've already booked the accommodations for Le Mans next year. So consider that hashtag happening. Hashtag allegedly, hashtag hopefully. Where am I going with this? Anyway, in the month of June, as we get closer to Le Mans, I'll be getting into full intolerable mode when it comes to hyping up that race and hyping up the fan experience there. So I'll just tune around for that episode and we'll try to give you some info for that. Been to IMS for SRO, great time and underrated. Otherwise, I've been to Road America, Laguna Seca, and Mid Ohio. Yeah, you get the West Coast and the
that's Central. All over the place.
Yeah. Most memorable sports car race you guys remember? I'll tell you what, the one that's most influential to me, I guess, is the way I'll answer this question, was the 2011 24 Hours of Le Mans. Before that race, the 24 Hours of Daytona was my favorite sports car race of the season, the one I look forward to the most. Sort of tied into me being a NASCAR, NASCAR kid growing up. Seeing them race at Daytona was a lot more familiar. Had a lot of NASCAR drivers in the field. When I saw the 2011 24 Hours of Le Mans, that battle between Audi and Peugeot the entire race, it was, sort of an underdog story with one Audi going up against three factory Peugeots for the entire race, or for the most part, with only one Audi being left for half the race. That's the one that really sticks with me the most. And since that race, which is now 13 years ago, my all-time favorite motor race. So that's the one I'll give you.
It's too difficult for me. I don't have a specific race that sticks out in my mind, but I do have a specific car. And that's the well, at least manufacturer of car and more driver. And that's Ron Fellows when he raced for Corvette back in the day. You know, I remember watching as a kid on TV him rip around in that iconic yellow Corvette. So, well, over the years. So that's the most memorable sports car related, I guess, memory that I have.
Good pick there, fellow countryman.
Oh yeah, well that's why Ron Fellows, you know, fellow Canadian and owner of a track now, continues to support sports car racing. So
yep. Yeah, I followed it up by saying 2011 Le Mans was one of the greatest races ever, was rooting for the French, but Audi and Ingenuity won. Great race. Yeah, yep. Fantastic. If you haven't seen it, you don't want to watch a full 24-hour race, I can understand that. Could just watch Truth in 24 too. It's on YouTube. And you can probably get the Audi's side of the story from that documentary.
Very well done.
Very well done. Jason Statham's the narrator in that. I'll tell you what. I think I'm going to wrap this episode up. We got another good amount of questions from everybody who tuned in. So thank you to anybody who tuned in with those. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I want to make sure I'm not incorrect in saying that. Yes, 2 weeks' time, we will have a bit of a preview for two races going on. We have the Long Beach Grand Prix for IMSA, and we have the 6 hours of Imola for the WEC. And then we'll be following that up the next week with a recap of both of those episodes. So you get the Rain Race Podcast 2 weeks in a row. And then we'll go on from there. So, want to thank you again for tuning into tonight's episode. Hope to catch you in the next one. Take care.